the virtues of youth. Last week I spoke on the virtues of aging, and the virtues of youth are a little bit different some of the time. One of the virtues of youth is fearlessness. And if it's not real fearlessness, it is at least pretended fearlessness, because you don't want to look like you're weak or like you're afraid and let anybody see the fear, because that just isn't right. I was really reminded of this today. I know it's a sermonic cliche. Today on my way to church, I had this insight. Today on the way to church, I woke up this morning at about 4 a.m. in Monterey, California, and took a cab that couldn't find the house, so I'm already in some state of anxiety, with a driver who had been driving all night and now was going to hit highway number one. I was finding that fearlessness was not the dominant sense that I had. In the dark and in the fog on Highway 1 on the way to the airport to take a puddle jumper down here. Now, normally that would be enough. But some of you know that I had a very long period of fear of flying, where I didn't pretend I wasn't afraid. I just stayed off of airplanes. And I stayed off of airplanes for some 20 years. And for 5 years before that, I tried to stay off of airplanes. And even when I joined the Peace Corps and we showed up at the airport to get on the airplane, I had taken the train to Brown to do the training, and we showed up at the airport to fly to Tunisia, North Africa, I didn't get on the plane. They called the psychologist over to talk to me about my fear. And he wanted to know about my childhood and toilet training and my relationship with my mother, which is really, it's hard to do in-depth psychotherapy at an airport with a 707 waiting to go. And he's giving me the, John, you got to get on that plane. Of course, the wrong thing to say to a Unitarian. Gotta, don't tell me any gotta. Well, John, it's not a plane. Looks like a 707 to me. It's a symbol, John. I said, don't go there. So finally the plane taxis. My wife is looking. And the poor psychologist is crying. So I find myself in this ridiculous position of my arm is around Harry and I'm saying, it's not your fault, Harry. You know, Freud himself couldn't have talked to me on that. Either 707 or symbol. You know, it's okay. I'm a difficult case. I began to get over my fear of flying when Helene and I became engaged, and she said, I'm going to Europe on our honeymoon. That concentrates the mind. And I decided that I would rather die than miss the honeymoon. Yeah, I'm still a junior high school guy, motivated by exactly the same things. Anyway, so I asked her, well, is it okay if I'm afraid? Will you think less of me if I show my fear? And she said, honey, I couldn't think less of you. This, again, is like 1018 or 1018. This is a phrase that could be understood in several ways. I decided to take the affirming and generous interpretation of it, and so I got on there and I accepted the fear. And that helped me get there. What had gotten me in the trouble in the first place was not accepting fear, that in my youthful enthusiasm, when my then girlfriend in high school said, you know, my mom, well, no, she didn't use that. That was not her voice. Let me try that again. When my girlfriend in high school said, you know, honey, my mom owns a skydiving club. Would you like to go skydiving? And I said, now the voice changed. And I said, sure, honey, I'm all man and afraid of nothing. Well, that, you know, high school guys lie to high school girlfriends. And so I was not all man, and I was afraid of lots of stuff, including jumping out of an airplane with a knapsack filled with laundry for all I know, and I was going to pull the ripcord and underwear would fly out. Underwear that obviously I could use on the way down. And so I go up. So I go up on the airplane and I climb. This is over Lake Elsinore. And I climb out and I'm standing on the thing and I hang on the strut. And you're attached with a ripcord. I'm sorry, with a static line. So in case you freeze and don't pull the chute. I was not about to freeze. There was some chance I was going to pull the emergency chute before I let go of the airplane. And so they feathered the prop, and the guy said, let go. I looked down 8,000 feet to a dry lake bed, and I'm going, you got to be kidding. What am I doing up here? And they said, we've already feathered the prop to get rid of the prop wash. You're out. Boom, and off I go. And my life, as brief as it had been, flashed before me. It is true. Things go into slow motion. And I'm sure my heart was racing, but it felt like it stopped as I was in free fall for only, I'm sure, microseconds. But the microseconds were long enough to read the collected works of Shakespeare. And it opened. I did not, even though it opened, I did not like hanging onto some nylon and cords and a harness. Looking down now, probably around 6,000 feet on a dry lake bed, it just felt insecure and uncomfortable. So it was my denial of my fear that caused me to do something I was uncomfortable with, that created a greater fear that I couldn't get over until I was ready to admit to the fear, to admit to the fact that I'm frightened of some things. And one of the lessons of this is that denial is not a helpful therapy in most situations. Understanding what touches you, what troubles you, and dealing with it, confronting it, is often very helpful, and it was certainly helpful to me. Somebody asked me how my flight was this morning on a little plane out of Monterey. I don't know. I was sound asleep. I've become a very comfortable flyer. But it began with the acceptance of my fear, not being afraid of being afraid. And that's important. And I think that one of the virtues of youth is fearlessness, but one of the other side of almost every virtue is a vice, and that is denial. It has always been interesting to me that when you look at what classically the church called the seven deadly sins, and I'm not going to go into all of them, they are all, and the word cardinal, it doesn't mean red, the cardinal sins, it comes from actually a Latin word for hinge, and it comes from door. All of those sins and almost all virtues are, if the door is shut, you're making a mistake, and if the door is fully open, you're making a mistake. There is the understanding that lust is an extension of the erotic, and the erotic is necessary. At the extreme open, it leads to problems. At the extreme closed, it leads to problems. Gluttony and appetite is necessary. Gluttony is not. They are not absolutes. They are always deals that we make. And we make deals with our fears. And one of the things from youth to middle age, to age, is how we accommodate those things that we fear, that some of which are irrational and some of which are completely rational. We had a Halloween party here last night. Halloween is actually one of my favorite holidays, although I like the images better. But they're related of the Mexican Day of the Dead. And the idea is for kids to learn how to be afraid by pretending to be afraid. When they're very, very young, it's interesting to watch our grandchildren go trick-or-treating, and they look at the monsters, and they look at the spiders and the cobwebs and all the stuff, and they're having, for the most part, a good time. Every once in a while, somebody in, because our oldest grandchildren live in an area near Studio City where there are a lot of people who are in the industry, sometimes the special effects are a little bit real and a little bit gory, but for the most part, they enjoy the frisson, the chills of being kind of afraid and knowing that there's no danger. One of the things of childhood is the enjoyment of safe fear, because we learn how to handle the unsafe fear. It's a kind of practice for that adrenaline rush, that epinephrine rush, that urge to jump backwards. I know at some point I outgrew horror movies. I never saw slasher movies, but all of the gory stuff that kids like, I understand why they like it. This is not an old guy saying, "Oh, that's awful and that's garbage." When you're young, it is good practice for a world that is often very frightening. And so one of the virtues of youth is fearlessness and pretended fearlessness, a way of beginning to deal with life's threats and the things that frighten us and that go bump in the night. When you're young, the things that go bump in the night are those ghosts and monsters under the bed. And what I love about the Day of the Dead and what I love about Halloween is, instead of going, there are ghosts under the bed, you don't have to take that literally, but every kid knows there are ghosts under the bed, is you invite them to tea. You have a tea party. You give them candy in the Halloween tradition. You make them dinner and lunch and an ofrenda. You bring them back, and the ghosts become friendly ghosts, and the monsters become fed and sated and become your friends. That's a wonderful way of processing, and for children to process, the things that we fear. Later on, as adults, those fears become different, and the monsters become a little bit different. They become human resources people, and they become bankers, and they become collection agencies, and they become doctors who are reading x-rays and MRIs. And the threats become real, so that's not nearly as much fun, and it's harder to buy them off with candy. But we have learned to some extent how to deal with fear, how to shake and be afraid and know that it is survivable emotionally to be afraid. And we learn that in youth. That's one of the wonderful things about childhood. Another wonderful thing about youth is their certainty. Now, it might be hubristic, it might be inappropriate, but that certainty that, you know, you guys are doing it all wrong. You adults messed up this world, and we're going to do a better job. And I remember those days. And I remember those days with some embarrassment for my certainty, but some nostalgia for the clarity of my vision, for the sense that I knew what was wrong with the world, and I knew that if we only did this, we could really make a difference. As I said last week, I still believe in the effort, but I have lost a lot of the hubris. But last week I said that I didn't miss the hubris, but upon mature reflection and wanting to be honest, yeah, I do miss some of the hubris. I miss sometimes those days when the world is not as, I didn't see the world as complex as I see it today, when decisions and actions were much more morally clear and politically clear. There is a reason that the Gordian knot sat there for centuries waiting for Alexander, a young man, to go, "It's a Gordian knot. You adults have been trying to untangle this knot for centuries." He said, "Huh. Really interesting. Fred, hand me the sword." What? And cut through the Gordian knot. Oh, I miss that. I miss being able to cut to the chase. To not say, look, I know, but then you get older, and it's, you know, it's more complicated than that. If you do this, that happens. If you do this morally, that happens. We had a wonderful discussion in adult ed last week about moral choices, about feeding people in this world. And our strategies are not easy. They're not clear. There are those laws of unintended consequences. And you say, oh, this would really be great. Why don't we do this? Yeah, that's a great idea, except did you consider this part? And we're now picking at the Gordian knot. We're looking for ways to untangle the complexities because in middle age, we know too much to cut through the knot. It's more complicated. There are more consequences. There's more interaction than we thought of when we were young. But then when we get old, there's a reason that grandparents and grandkids have great relationships often. And it's not just they have a common enemy, the kids. Part of it is that those kids are ready to cut through the Gordian knot, and at some point when you get old enough, it's, you know, I don't have time to untangle this mess either. Just cut to the chase. Let's just do it. And that is one of the virtues of youth that gets picked up again by many in old age. Part of what the great virtue of youth is, I think, is that cutting through the Gordian knot, that sense of certainty. Now, I know one of the cliches about the difference between grown-ups, and I still think that at major holidays I get to sit at the kids' table, and it's always a shock when there are two other generations that are sitting at the kids' table and there's no room for me and they want me to sit with the adults. But one of the things about that is we always talk about children being filled with wonder at the world, at those eyes that are filled with wonder. I thought about that, and I actually don't think that's true. I think that children assume that what they see is normal, that they can adjust to almost anything. If it's a war zone, they adjust to a war zone, would break us. Technology. I watched my granddaughter Roxy when she was 3 years old operating the mouse on the computer and doing surfing the web and playing interactive games. And I'm going, honey, can you show me how to do that? I'm looking at wonder at the computer, and it's part of the landscape for her. She doesn't have a sense of wonder. Sense of wonder, I think, actually is more adult. It's, I don't understand it, but it's working, and wow. And kids go, of course, it's always been like this. One of the great virtues of youth is its ability to adjust and the ability to learn, to take in new information. Young people are sponges, not in the way that you people who are still paying for the college education of your kid mean in terms of sponges, but they are sponges for learning. Look at language acquisition for children. Language teachers will tell you it's very hard to teach an adult. It's even harder to teach a smart adult because they'll think and not just let it happen. Almost nobody in their native language can speak their native language. It's not an IQ issue. It's a letting go. It's a letting the learning happen. And I know kids who speak 2-3 languages, and for the first 4 years of their lives, they didn't know which language was which. If they were speaking to part of their family in Spanish and part of their family in English, they knew that you talked to Tia Marie in Spanish and to Grandpa Mark in English. They knew that my wife, whose first language was Yiddish, knew who to speak Yiddish to and who to speak English to. But if you had asked her, are these different languages? It's, well, no, we talk to Grandma like this, and we talk to my girlfriend Susie like this. Eventually, they learn to take those languages apart, and eventually, as adults, we start thinking about the rules instead of letting the language happen. I remember the first time I made an attempt to learn Arabic. I was on a bus between Djerba and Tunis, before Peace Corps. This was a year before Peace Corps. And so I turn to the gentleman next to me on the bus and I say, well, I'd like to learn some Arabic. What's the verb to be? This was all in French. I said, what's the verb etre? And he said, well, etre isn't a verb. Okay, that's the building block of language in the West, so let me try this again. I'm flexible. I'm still young enough to be flexible. What's the verb to have? Have isn't a verb. It's a state of being. I said, thank you very much. Have a nice trip. I think I'll take a nap. Eventually, I learned Arabic when I stopped thinking and let it happen and learned it the way a child would learn it, in context, without thinking about the rules. That's the great virtue of youth, the ability to learn. When most of us, in the religious tradition, we look at religious art, we think of prophets as a bunch of old, usually white men with long gray hair and white beards. I think that if you look at how old prophets likely were, they were probably young during their prophetic periods, and very few of them outlived their prophetic periods. One of the things about being a prophet, one of the things about being a youth, is that you are not constrained by conventional wisdom. Prophets seldom become priests, ministers, ecclesiastical figures, because they stand out of the conventional. They reject the conventional wisdom and see it as folly, and they shout, you're wrong, you're misled, this is not the right thing to do. Shatter, throw away those chains, shatter those old things that are keeping you back. This is why they seldom live to kind of enjoy their retirement, because the establishment usually says to prophets, it's been nice hearing from you. Would you, you know, that fast that you were undertaking for 5 days? Could you make it for 60 days and no water? Kids, young people, are often able to look at the conventions and say no. Some of the best work of some of the great artists, whether Einstein or other people who have had breakthroughs in thought, in creation, in the arts and in the sciences and in philosophy, whether an Einstein or a Wittgenstein or even people whose last names don't end in Stein, are people who did their best work in their youth, who had insights that shattered conventional thinking and conventional wisdom. Having shattered conventional wisdom, they then have to wait for wisdom. That wisdom, as I said last week, is the payoff, for the conceivable payoff for getting older. But in the meantime, for the young, there is fearlessness, there is certainty, there's a new kind of vision and the potential for creativity. We don't want our young people to be adults too soon. We don't want them... I know, over here I'm seeing it. No danger, right? We don't want our young people to become mature adults too soon. We want our young people to be children, to have fresh eyes for learning, to learn how to wonder at the world, and to stick around with just enough safety, with all of the bravery and the denial and the bravado, to stay on the planet long enough to get the payoff, which is wisdom. And the wisdom that accepts some constraints of convention in order to grow as people and in order to learn how that door of love and lust, of appetite and so forth, how it moves and adjusts. And the wisdom to know how to adjust those doors. You do not expect wisdom from children, but creativity. And finally, the greatest virtue of youth, Though it doesn't always seem that way from a parent or even a grandparent's viewpoint, is energy. The energy. Boundless, renewable energy. And that's probably the only part where I look at and I say, you know, I miss the certitude, but I can live with its compensations. That energy thing, though, you found a pill for energy for me, I'm ready for that. But for the rest of it, I'll take wisdom, but I'll admire the creativity. I'll admire the freedom. I'll admire the ability of young people to be iconoclasts, to find those icons that people bow to that are, in a sense, false gods, and take them and throw them down and shatter them with the idealistic belief that they can build something better. Older people need younger people for inspiration, for creativity, and for energy. So there are virtues at every stage of life. There are snares and traps and illusions and delusions at every stage of life. And we celebrate all of them and accept all of them as being worthwhile potentially, and each person as deserving recognition, dignity, and the right to be treated with respect and caring, and to have their creativity and their lives and their own spiritual and intellectual searches, which never stop, helped, and to keep each other company as we are on these journeys of spirit, of body, and of time.